I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each week we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Today we are talking about Moulin Rouge, the 2001 film.
Michael, pronounce the exclamation point.
I did. I tried to be as excited as without yelling.
Try it again. Once more with feeling.
Today we're talking about Moulin Rouge! The 2001 film directed by Baz Luhrmann, screenplay by Baz Luhrmann and Craig Pierce. I'm joined by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Arand.
Hello, everybody.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
Before we dive into Moulin Rouge and all the things that we want to talk about, our question for Spotify listeners is, what is your favorite song from Moulin Rouge? I want to know. I'm really excited to read them all and then listen to them all, probably on Spotify. Plug Spotify. There you go. So let's dive in. So Moulin Rouge, let's all talk about our first experiences with this film. For people our age, this was a film that you had an opinion on, I think, generally speaking. And this is where, Brian, it'll be interesting to see if the slight age difference that we have now was created a different experience for you.
Eh?
Leave Uncle Brian alone.
I was, 14, I believe, when this came out in high school and at the height of hopeless romanticism and getting into film. And this film was, just to borrow Alex's phrase, this was a cinemagasm if ever there was one. Perhaps my first.
Wow.
You were a cinemagasm virgin until this movie. Aww,
cinemagasms for the very first time.
So many of us were.
Yes. I don't remember where I saw this movie the first time. It's kind of like Star Wars, because I've seen it so many times. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's just always been with me, but I was obsessed with it. And, the way, movies at this time, they would reveal certain aspects of filmmaking, because they were so obvious. So like American Beauty, Road to Perdition taught me about cinematography, because the cinematography is just so beautiful. And The West Wing taught me about dialogue or whatever. Mm. Moulin Rouge taught me what the power of editing could do. And we're absolutely going to talk about that. But so I want to hear from you guys. Trisha, what was your first experience and your first thoughts about Moulin Rouge?
I saw Moulin Rouge in theaters, and it is like, especially back in that day for me, just like check all of my boxes. It is so melodramatic and crazy and this like wild ride of emotions. It's all romance. It's all music and just like feelings, all the feelings about life and art and what freedom, beauty, truth, and love, I think. Mostly. Yeah. And it was, I had a Moulin Rouge poster on my bedroom wall.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It was one of like my four bedroom wall posters. It's like that and The Matrix. And it is such a celebration of what art does and can do, right? Like, it encourages this outpouring of just like raw feeling. And it's not cool, I'm gonna say, in the literal sense, right? If you think about the origins of the like idea of cool, which literally means not hot or not passionate, it is the opposite of that. It is incredibly passionate. It wears its heart on its sleeve and wants you to do the same as an audience member. And so it is not in any way cool. And fortunately, I was not cool. And so this was my movie, basically. That's how I feel.
I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think the context also for like for younger listeners, to like understand, because I recently was on a Nebula original with Alex from the YouTube channel Technicality, where he does this thing where he does this show where he interviews people about movies
like
and
us.
Like, right. And so like Moulin Rouge came out the year that he was born. And so I had to kind of like remember, okay, this is like, you don't understand. And like the summer that it came out, like the soundtrack, just everything around it.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like there's just a lot.
Lady Marmalade.
Lady Marmalade and all this stuff.
On repeat.
But it was definitely a movie where you kind of loved it or hated it. And there was conversation about it even back then. The context of Moulin Rouge is really fascinating. Yeah. Brian, what was it like for you? What was your first experience with Moulin Rouge?
The way I was told to see the movie was my very dear friend Abby, who was my sort of Winnie Cooper in middle school and high school in the beginning of college. We had some sort of drama where we decided to take some time apart, like even as friends, just like, let's just kind of not speak for a while. I asked her about it the other day. Neither of us can remember what the hell it was about.
It was because you were secretly in love with each other and you couldn't be friends at that time.
Well, sure. But that was true of like the previous 7 years, sure. too. So, and we were fine with it. The silence was broken when she left a message on my answering machine one day, which I'll explain to you kids what that is later. And she said, hey, I know we're not supposed to be speaking or whatever, but if you haven't seen Moulin Rouge yet, you have to go see it. Okay, bye. And so I did. I went to the theater, I think, by myself and just put myself through the experience of Moulin Rouge, especially in a theater, especially by yourself, just sort of letting it all wash over you. And all was right with the world. I was in college when this came out, and I was a theater kid with theater friends. So this became the movie we were just running around singing songs from all the time. I also had a Moulin Rouge poster on my dorm room wall in my sophomore room. Yep.
Exactly.
I would wear my black coat with a collar up while walking through the cold and pretend I was Ewan McGregor in the Roxanne scene.
Yeah.
It's a movie that I love. I've always had a little bit of a love-hate relationship with it, though, because I'm not a big fan of the cartooniness of it, the over-stylized sort of nature of it. I'm not a big musicals guy. I'm not a big farce person, and I'm not a big stylized movie guy either. Hmm. Granted, there are musicals I love. There are stylized movies I love. There are like ridiculous comedies I love, but it's sort of like a lot of things that I'm not crazy about all in like the first act of this movie.
Right. Front loads all that stuff.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So overall, I love the movie. It has some stuff that drives me bananas that we can get into a little bit later. But it's definitely a movie where the good outweighs the bad very much. And I enjoy watching it. I hadn't seen it a little bit, so it was really fun to rewatch it for this.
Yeah, and I think, again, like you're saying, that the beginning basically dares you to like keep watching.
It tests like, you, for sure. Yeah.
It's like a literal acid test.
Right. And I remember watching it like with my parents and like different people that I would show it to. And you could kind of feel whether or not people were like, oh, we're on board this train, or like, no, I'm going to get off this train.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah. Yeah. Moulin Rouge. Cool. Alex.
So it's interesting because I did not see this movie when it first came out in theaters. And I remember following the Oscars really closely that year because it was Fellowship of the Ring year also. Mm-hmm. And right. I was, of course, rooting for Lord of the Rings at the Oscars. And I saw all these clips from Moulin Rouge in the Oscar ceremony. And there was such a wide variety of types of clips. There were these, you know, I think for some categories, it was showing some of the early stuff of like the can-can dancers and just like complete chaos, like goofiness. And I was like, okay, what is this movie? And then Nicole Kidman was nominated and they showed her performance from like the very end of the movie where she turns around and begins singing Come What May. And it looked like this like really beautifully done moment. And I was like, wait, that's like a different movie. Wait, what is this movie? Mm-hmm. So I had this very strange, like, how can this all be one movie? I don't know what this is. And I kind of just forgot about it because it just seemed so strange to me. And then the summer after high school, I went on like a date with a guy and we were both going to go off to different colleges. And so it was like, you know, it was like whatever, but you know, it was my first like time dating anybody ever. And so I was like, oh, it's so tragic. Like we're going to different colleges. So it just can't be. And you know, it is what it is. And my really good friend Megan in high school, she was like, you know what? I think I have the movie for you. We have to watch Moulin Rouge. And so she like picked it out for like my, you know, woe is me.
Sad.
Yeah, like we can't be together. And and we watched it and she was absolutely right. It was exactly the right movie for like that, you know. It wasn't even first love, it was like first date, you know, but it was right. It was that same mindset of just like everything is melodramatic and tragic and life is hard and love is hard and you know, all those teen feelings, like the movie just channeled all of it 1,000%.
Yes.
And so I loved it. I was definitely not necessarily on board in the first act. I was very unnerved by it and was not sure what I was getting into. By the end of the movie, I was just so like sold. I absolutely loved it. And I thanked her for making me watch it.
Well, it's interesting. We've used this word melodrama a couple of times now. And it reminds me so much that I don't think this happened in the theater that I was in, But, you know, the tradition of melodrama, which this is borrowing heavily from, invites audience participation. And so, like, you're supposed to boo the villain and cheer when the hero comes on and, you know, be loud and cry and basically and laugh as loud as you want as well. And I showed this recently to a group of teens who had never seen it before. And they pretty immediately, I mean, they were, you know, this was right before COVID started. It was in February of 2020 that I showed them this movie. And they were pretty immediately like in that headspace where they started having vocal reactions and they were like throwing popcorn when the Duke was on screen and like full on melodrama kind of reactions, which I think is what this movie wants from you. Right. And maybe, you know, as you mentioned, Brian, maybe it's hard as an audience member, if you're not in the right headspace or you have different expectations, to like be thrown around like that with your emotions. Cause it does feel like a roller coaster ride where it's trying to give you whiplash, where it's like, now cry, now laugh. Like, you're like, oh, what am I doing?
One thing that I've learned when reading up more about the making of this film was how much of the inspiration came from Bollywood, which is a form of this kind of like wild tone swinging melodrama, you know, crazy dance numbers, things that just almost feel like too big and too out of control to be reasonable. That's like the Bollywood vibe. And Baz Luhrmann actually was in India researching a different project. And he went to a big movie theater with like 2000 people packed in and saw this like 3-hour Bollywood epic. And he was saying the audience was booing and cheering and laughing. And, you know, I don't know if they had popcorn, but they would have been throwing popcorn if they did. Yeah. He had this thought of like, wow, everything right now is so cool. As you were saying, Tricia, like American cinema was aiming for cool, was aiming for kind of ironic coolness. That was what was in. And he was wondering and kind of challenging himself, can I bring this Bollywood exuberance to an American audience? Can I translate this into one of my films? Because he really loved the experience of being in that Bollywood theater where you can have total farcical slapstick comedy one second and then have the most tragic, dramatic thing happen the next second. That kind of experience that he had in that Bollywood theater, he wanted to replicate that in Moulin Rouge. And I think, you know, it's there.
For sure.
It's cool to hear, yeah, that kids these days can still like get into it and click into that mode.
Well, there's no better time to click into that mode than when you're a teen and your hormones are actually racing and doing that to you at every moment.
Right.
So
also the moment that I think I've never watched this movie and had someone not gasp, but like during the midpoint section where Christian, when the Duke is like, why shouldn't she choose the Maharaja? And he says, because she doesn't love you.
Yes.
Like everyone gasps. Yep. Like even if it's been completely quiet the entire time, everyone is like, oh no. Like, and that's just so, it's so cool to be able to make a movie that pulls that out of people, that forces people to have that kind of reaction. That's the thing that I appreciate about Baz Luhrmann generally, is his kind of approach to cinema, where, you know, it's not trying to trick you into thinking what you are watching is reality, or to judge it as if you were watching a real anything happening. You know, his movies very clearly from the beginning, like literally, and
open with a red curtain parting. Here you are in a theater. Yes,
a crazy conductor, like kick conducting.
I love the conductor.
Yes. Yeah, it's just so clearly signaling to you, like, you are going to watch a movie. I'm going to tell you a story. This isn't reality. Go on this, like, adventure with me. And I really appreciate movies that do that, because most don't. Like, most, again, try to hide it in some way. And I think, you know, part of, I'd seen Romeo plus Juliet before watching Moulin Rouge, and like I kind of had a love-hate relationship with that. You know, I think we watched it in my 9th grade English class, and it was like, yeah, it's cool that they're like modernizing Shakespeare, but this is a little much also, but that's kind of cool at the same time. Like, there's just a lot of complicated feelings, and I feel like Moulin Rouge is like the right setting and a world, like all of those pieces come together. It's a movie about show business, and so like the style and the bigness of the show that you are being shown kind of feeds into the themes and everything inside. And so it's the happy marriage of all these things coming together. And I think that's why it works so well for me in this film and maybe doesn't so much in some of his other films.
That was definitely my experience with Romeo and Juliet also was I was like, some of this stuff is cool in a vacuum. Like if you were just showing me this like 5 minute short film, that's like Mercutio singing a song or whatever. But when I'm like, you know, like, oh, fetch me my longsword. Look, the gun has longsword. That's the brand of the gun. Do you get it?
It's a sword on it.
Right. And I think that's sort of where things, you know, start to feel a little, I can't help but get taken out of it. I think when it is like the shots in Moulin Rouge, where it's like, here's the whole town. Clearly these are all like CG Compton actors just so we could do this crazy push and like everything looks completely fake and stuff. And that's a choice, you know, but I think it's one of those things where I'm like, okay, but now I'm like not thinking about this world anymore. I'm thinking about like, what is this thing that doesn't look like a movie? And yeah, there's like a gaudiness, a very purposeful gaudiness to this movie that I think is just not my taste. I think the intro to the Moulin Rouge, the can-can like whole number and everything. I'm just like, these like old creepy men are singing Nirvana at me, like right into my face. And then you have like the Sound of Music scene, spectacular. And then after the first act, then Lerman pulls away and lets the movie sort of be serious. But there's still this sense for me personally of, oh, wow, what an emotional song. I'm in tears. Wait, why is the moon singing opera? Like, I'm like trying to. And I've mentioned before how much I hate like at the end when the gun flies out the window and boops the Eiffel Tower, like right at the emotional climax of the movie. Like, what the hell is happening? But I think for me, the Sound of Music sequence is like everything. It's like maybe one of the hardest things for me to watch of any movie that I actually enjoy. Like there are movies I don't like where I don't like a lot of it. And again, this is all very purposeful. Like, you know, he made the movie he was trying to make, obviously.
Yeah.
But I'm just like in that sequence where you introduce all these crazy characters, there's like just total chaos. There's extreme camera angles. There's like Looney Tunes sound effects happening all over the place. The characters are all insane. The editing is bonkers. Like there are characters who are in different positions between two different cuts and stuff where I'm like, how are you in a different place than you just were? You know, the after Christian sings the Sound of Music and the characters are kind of mulling it over, the pianist is like, off music, and like doing these like very, I'm just like, what the hell? And I think if I never heard of this movie before and just put it on, like I would probably be like, okay, I'm not going to watch the rest of this, you know? And I think that's what's unfortunate about that stylized thing of this movie for me is that that's not what the movie ends up being. That it's sort of like all this like cartoony stuff packed into the first act. And then it's like, but we are going to get really serious and emotional later, but you might lose. And, you know, Baz Luhrmann, like you said, it's challenging you to watch the rest of the movie. It's sort of like, look, if you don't like this stuff, then just get out of here because I'm making a movie for the people who do like this stuff, you know? And I get super sucked back into it then after that. There's also sitcom logic, like a lot of sitcom logic in the first act where it's like, the one he's waving the handkerchief at, hold on, let me turn I can see. Yeah, do you mean him? Right. Hold on, let me turn so I can see. Yes, that's who it is.
That's kind of Shakespeare. I think that's like mistaken identity stuff is like Shakespearean kind of references. Yeah.
Comedy of errors.
Yeah, exactly.
But then the very sitcom-y thing to me is like, you know, Christian's talking about poetry and Satina's talking about sex. And, you know, it's sort of like, oh, it's very modern what I do. Like, I hope you like it. Oh, I'm sure I will.
That scene goes on for a long time.
Right. Yeah.
And that is the only joke at the heart of the scene. It's the one joke scene.
But I also love Nicole Kidman's like commitment to that
scene.
Sure. Like, yeah. She is so committed.
Right. But then, yeah, at the same time, when we do get into like your song, Come What May, Roxanne, Elephant Love Medley, I'm just like, this is everything I do want from a movie, you know, but it's this weird, the reason I say love hate is because it's like some of my favorite things in a movie that I like, and also some of my least favorite things in a movie I like. It's almost like if you would watch 10 minutes of The Lord of the Rings and be like, now here's 5 minutes of The Hobbit, now here's 10 minutes of Lord of the Rings again. It's just like switching back and forth so much between those extremes. But again, once I get over that like hump of that first act, then I'm way into it. And yeah.
Yeah.
When I think about this movie, I think about the definition of the word entertainment. Mm. Like, what do we think of as being entertainment? And sometimes that's tragedy and crying, right? Like people going, you know, back as far as theater has ever existed is like, we want to see a really tragic story that ends in like everybody dying. And that's entertainment, right? That qualifies as being something that takes us out of our everyday lives and is entertainment. At the same time, really broad slapstick comedy, that's entertainment, right? And same thing that we have with like the love story here, same thing we have with like the music. We go to concert halls just to see music, to be taken out of our own heads by the experience of music. And that is also the definition of entertainment. And what this is doing is mashing every form of entertainment up together and throwing it into one movie. And so it's almost like, I don't know what genre you would call this. It's a musical, but like, is musical itself a genre or is it a form, right?
It's a format, right?
Sure. So what genre, I don't know, you would call this exactly.
It's Bollywood.
I mean, it's so unto itself. Entertainment. It's spectacular, you might say.
It is the show they're putting on.
You might even say it twice.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much, I feel like, in this to unpack, and everything that you were talking about, Brian, is, I think, super valid and relevant.
For sure.
Where do we want to start? The editing. And as you're talking about that, yeah, the Sound of Music scene is insane. In every conceivable possible way, the way that is put together, as you detailed, is insanity. And I think for me, what works for it and what ultimately the purpose of is, it's almost like we go into a movie theater with a certain set of expectations about, this is film language and this is how a movie is going to reveal itself to me. And the first 20, 30 minutes of this movie just like smash that to pieces. Like, it just completely breaks any expectation you have of how a movie is supposed to tell you things.
Yes.
And that is an uncomfortable experience for sure, and a risky thing to do. But I think for me, what it allows is for it to then reassemble itself and put you in a framework where, like, I'm more open to the same kind of experimental, crazy editing that doesn't make sense. There isn't, like, continuity is not a thing that we are concerned about in any shape or form. Later on is used to really enhance the emotion of these moments and work with the music and all these things. It kind of creates this freedom and this new way of being able to convey all these things that I think is really powerful later on. And I think it only has the leeway to go to those places because it's already been stretched past the breaking point earlier. And so I think that's just one of the interesting kind of weird things about this movie, is that it ultimately is something unique and has a language unto its own, but it kind of has to traumatically break what we want from a movie first in order to do that.
Exactly.
It's interesting because I used to be in your camp, Brian, where I kind of gritted my teeth through the first act of this movie just to get to your song, basically. And then from there on out, I'm good. Now, when I watch it, I actually love deeply paying attention to the first act of this movie because I no longer am like embarrassed for it or feeling like it's wrong or I need to get past it. It's now I'm more just fascinated with it. It feels like everything in some of these sequences is just like improvised. Like, the filmmaking itself feels like entirely improvised, and yet
it does.
And yet it's going in and out of song and things that have to definitely be pre-planned and like pre-composed and pre-envisioned, but it feels so out of control and couldn't possibly be planned, right? So I think I'm fascinated with it now in a different way than I used to be, because how do you do a film that by its very nature has to be meticulously planned feel this way, where it's like, this seems like a stream of consciousness. This doesn't feel like anybody planned this. This is insane.
Yeah, I think part of the thing with the Sound of Music scene too is that it's the first really big recognizable melody from pop culture that we get. So before that, we have Nature Boy, which is a Nat King Cole song.
Yeah.
You know, I'm familiar with, but it's not like one of his most popular, you for sure know it kind of songs. And then we have Rufus Wainwright singing a little melody in the background, which is like a French folk song, I believe. It kind of doesn't do much with the music before we get to Ewan McGregor just belts out The Hills Are Alive with the Sound of Music to a very familiar melody. And everyone is acting like they've never heard it before in their lives. And it is very jarring. Now, ultimately, you know, the realization, the movie starts with that, and then it takes us through Children of the Revolution, and it takes us into, you know, the entire can-can and the,
Nirvana.
Yeah, David Bowie. Yeah.
Yeah, the rap right. melody and Lady Madonna. Marmalade. And like, yep, yeah, it takes us into that like mashup scene at the Moulin Rouge. And we start to understand that it's purposefully tapping into, you know, a century's worth. I mean, mostly the last several decades, but really like a century's worth of musical influences and references that are supposed to awaken different things in us that we like. Some are going to be really familiar to the average listener. Some are going to be more obscure. So like One Day I'll Fly Away is not an original song to this movie, but not it wasn't like a smash hit like something like some of these other ones are, right? Mm. Or that you would definitely be familiar. It's not like a Virgin is what I'm saying.
Right, right. It smells like Teen Spirit or
yeah.
Right, right. So putting The Sound of Music first is, you know, it's the risk that we're talking about for that reason also, because the melodic, the melody itself is so familiar,
right?
And like such so embedded in film language and in musical history, you're just kind of like wait what is this? And you have to give it time to get there. And
right, yeah, it also smartly sets up the by having the characters have never heard the song before, you know, which is telling the audience this song doesn't exist, but also this movie is set in 1900, you know, 60 years before The Sound of Music. So it does a nice bit of work there where it's like, these songs don't exist in this universe. Also, right. We're going to use songs from whatever the hell time period we feel like. And we're just inventing this brand new universe. And to actually have a scene that is sort of built around that concept is a nice way to be like, get ready, because in 5 minutes or 10, like your mind is going to explode with all these references. So we're kind of easing you into
Kylie Minogue's going to be a green fairy and yeah, right. we're off to the Roll races. Yeah.
And I really love Spectacular Spectacular, which is a melody a lot of people are familiar with, but they wouldn't be able to go, oh, that's Offenbach, you know, because they probably don't know their opera, you know, whatever. But like, it's just counting on you to know some of it and go with the rest of it. And that's a big ask.
I mean, look, if you're my age, you remember that melody from the early 90s when it was Pizza Hut's number 1-800-831-1111, which I have still not forgotten.
Wow.
That damn number, because it's emblazoned into my brain.
We should call that number and see if we can get some pizza.
Well, it's interesting because Baz Luhrmann talked a little bit about the logic behind using contemporary songs or songs from, you know, what's been referred to as like the MTV era, like the music mm-hmm. video era, a lot of the right. the big numbers are. And he was talking about one that at some point in kind of theatrical musical history, it was more commonplace for musicals to incorporate popular songs or mm-hmm. pre-existing songs. They didn't have to be entirely original. That wasn't expected of a musical. Like, I think we now think a musical, if it isn't entirely original, is doing something wrong or it's stealing.
Well, it's a jukebox musical.
Right, this is a jukebox musical. Right.
It's somehow lesser than an original right. musical, yeah.
Right. But at some point, that was more expected. And there is also this meta aspect to, you know, they had to figure out a way to make Christian's character come off to the other characters as this genius, as ahead of his time, as this modern poet. And what better way to do that than to just have him kind of thinking of all these songs before they came out later. Mm. And instead of trying to make a song that universally the audience would agree is a great song or is genius, take songs that the audience already loves. And mm-hmm. that is what the show is going to be based around. We all already love them, so we don't have to be convinced that Christian's a genius songwriter. Like, we're already down with your song and all these things. So mm-hmm. that was actually a really smart choice, because it is annoying and uncomfortable in film when you have maybe a writer or a singer, and within the world of the film, they are supposedly the best of their time or
right, right.
a genius artist. And if you don't really like what they're doing, it takes you out of the movie suddenly, because you're like, oh, but like, is that genius? That kind of just sounds bad. Mm. And to have him sing The Sound of Music, like, nobody's gonna think that's a bad song.
Right.
It's just, you know, you can't deny The Sound of Music.
Yeah.
You're basically describing like Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip's like main problem for me is like everybody in that show, because it's a late night comedy show, and like there are some people that are like, they're stars, like they can't do anything that's not funny, and like the jokes are amazing, and you watch it and you're like, are they?
Yeah.
Like,
right.
It's hard enough to just write a show, Sorkin. It's a whole other thing. Like, write a show and then a sketch comedy show within that show that's also a genius. Like, it's a, yeah. Yeah, I want to just because we need to say her name. Jill Bilcock is the editor, and she's edited a bunch of movies. There's a documentary, apparently, that came out recently about her and how influential she was, especially in Australia. It doesn't look like it's available in our region, unfortunately, but I really want to watch it. Because just quickly going back to what you were saying, Alex, there's this momentum that happens, especially in this first section that we're talking about, where it's like, this feels out of control and completely unplanned, but also somehow we know it had to be planned. And I feel like just so much of the movie's success like rests on her shoulders and just the ability to take what was shot. And I think this is part of the benefit of throwing out the rules like we're talking about in this early sequence, where it's like we're only limited to shots where there is physical continuity, or you could clearly see like the transition from this space to that. Like, it would be making this movie with like hands tied behind your backs.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why watching this opening sequence, like frame by frame, is really fascinating. There is enough connection that you know, as an audience member, kind of intuitively, because that's all that your brain has time to register.
Yeah.
Like, there's a green fairy and she's going to fly here and we're going to go down into, there's an elephant and I'm kind of in an open space. And I think I just went through a door and I think I'm inside somewhere now. And like, there's like 10 shots stitched together within, you know, 24 frames, but somehow it's done just right and timed with everything that it does take you on this journey. And it's just amazing to watch and to think about as an editor. Like, this is what film can also do. Like, there's conventional language, but there's also all these other opportunities at your disposal.
When you talk about editing, you talk about like, what's the function of an edit, you know? So if you cut to someone's reaction, it's because we need to see what that character's reaction is or whatever, you know? And this movie is like, the function is purely for aesthetics. For a lot of the edits, you know, there, when Nicole Kidman first shows up and sings her first line, she gets about two words in before we cut to like some random dancers. And then we cut back to her during the Sound of Music scene. It keeps cutting back to Christian typing at the typewriter. Like, no, we get he's typing. We don't need to be reminded that he is typing the story, because we just spent a few minutes with him as he's typing the story. So it's sort of clearly not there for functional reasons. It's just there for this aesthetic of like, this is the kind of sort of music video experience we're trying to give you.
I would argue that it goes beyond just surface level aesthetics, because I do agree with what Michael, I think, is getting at, that it puts your mind almost into this intuitive state. You're no longer watching for continuity or for like a piecing together of a solid reality, but you're almost more in this just pure emotion mind state that is just a flow of images and emotion and sense, like senses. And it's not trying to convey to you like a solid, like, watch this scene of this reality happening. It's like, no, you're on a wave of emotion and sense information.
Right. And that was all I was saying. I wasn't saying it's bad to just have sort of aesthetic, like, edits just for aesthetic purposes, you know?
Right.
Well, the other thing that the editing really does here, especially during that opening sequence we're talking about at the Moulin Rouge, with all of the dancers in all of their amazing costumes.
Yeah. The production design.
This movie won 2 Oscars for production design and for costume design, which it definitely deserved. It deserved more Oscars than those. But when I watch that opening scene and I see every single can-can dancer is in a different, amazing outfit, it's tremendous. But when we're in that scene, the other thing the editing really does for us is build out the world. Obviously, there's a huge set. Obviously, there are hundreds of people packed in here. And they're doing well-choreographed, very large dance numbers. Like, even when you're watching Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, which is the one, you know, Nicole Kidman comes down from the ceiling. Mm-hmm. There's 2 parts to that song, because we go back to it later. How does she get back on the swing? Don't worry about that. Don't even think about it. Even when we're watching that, there's a massive company that's dancing the entire time. And not just on the dance floor. They're dancing on the edges and the periphery, and you can see them because we cut to them there, you know, periodically. Instead of taking this enormous, huge well choreographed, beautifully choreographed dance number and showing us these really long shots and takes of it. We're cutting around within it, which helps us stay connected to the various characters, but also, yeah, is creating the feeling, the chaotic feeling of the world. And it's kind of pushing the bounds of the world out and out where it feels like we're in the room and we are visually looking around and like we're taking in different little moments, capturing the different emotions and little just like little vignettes that are happening at every corner of the room. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about the first party scene in Gatsby, and you get the feeling that what you were going for, and that was kind of what you have here that creates that, like, this is an enormous party and it's trying to plop you into what it feels like to be in an enormous party. But I think it really works here because of the editing in a way that it doesn't quite work as well in Gatsby.
Well, and Baz Luhrmann, he also said he wanted to make the Moulin Rouge feel modern to a modern audience, like feel like as epic as the most epic modern dance club. And,
right.
And if you had more traditional editing or shooting of the sequence, it might feel more old timey. Like it's a more old timey kind of entertainment.
Exactly. That's a good point.
But the cumulative chaos and like sensory overwhelm of the sequence feels more like a modern club experience. And you're cutting to all these different dancers and a snake charmer. And there's so much happening all at once. You have that sensory overload that I think wouldn't come from a more traditional, like, this is a period piece about this old timey entertainment.
Yep.
Right. It's one of the few times I feel like I want movies to be in VR, just because it's like you can't show everything in the club and show like the main action that is at the foreground of your story at the same time, short of like some weird picture in picture thing, which I'm glad is not like a thing that we try to do. So the best you can do is everything you're talking about with the editing in this movie. But it's almost like I want to be able to look forward at the stage and see what's going on, but also just turn my head around and be able to see all the other crazy crap happening.
Yeah.
While doing all of that, it is also telling the story. Like, even if it is sitcom logic, you know, you are getting like, okay, she's going to meet with someone, but she thinks it's this person, it's going to be the other. So it is also setting up all of this stuff and all these characters and just, the balance of when you're showing what is pretty incredible.
Yeah, that's one thing this movie does really well. The editing, not only in how it's bouncing back and forth between cuts, but also in how it's being paced, is you're always moving forward onto the next thing. Like you're telling a story while also showing this thing and having this emotional beat. I know this was like adapted into a stage show in the past few years. I don't know how long it is, but it certainly feels like if you were doing this as a stage show, it would have to be almost an hour longer just to sort of do all the things that editing is able to do in this movie.
For sure. Yeah. And that's, I think, one of the things that I wanted to bring up also is the dynamics. Like it speeds up, it goes crazy, but then it gets quiet. And like before like Satine comes on, like it's quiet, the color changes, the light, I feel like Jill, the editor, is like wielding brightness as a tool also. Like there's even that moment where like right before a Satine comes out, you see there's a can-can dancer and then she lifts up her skirt and there's this like abrupt cut to just like the white of her skirt and it just like blows out the screen and then it like cuts to darkness. And so there's just visually dynamics happening along with the music as the story is going. And it is really interesting as it then goes into the second act and kind of settles into the story, like we were talking about earlier, it does kind of change its rhythm and focuses in on this story and lets you just sit and like, you know, the elephant love medley where you kind of just get to hang out with Ewan McGregor and Nicole Kidman on top of an elephant. Like there are lots of long, admittedly shaky, like techno crane shots. Like I kind of wish they'd stabilize some of that, but there is this room to just kind of sit and sink into their relationship and kind of fall in love with the characters and this place and all the details that come along with all of that.
Yeah, I think it's really striking how little editing there is in some of those sequences. In Someday I'll Fly Away, Elephant Love Medley, there are long takes where they're just on screen singing at each other and we're not cutting back and forth a lot. And you've got the I Will Always Love You moment where you actually circle around them. And that's just, you know, cinemagasm right there. 100%. It's exploding, you know, I don't know what you even describe their surroundings as being. Just
fireworks.
So, yeah.
Right.
Wallpaper fireworks.
Right. Opera moon.
Yeah. Opera Moon, absolutely. I love Opera Moon. I'm down for Opera Moon.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really striking when it gets to that, because you have been so overwhelmed by the editing in the first act.
Yeah.
That these moments feel more special in a way, because we're slowing down, because we're just sitting with the characters. That's another, I think, benefit of that crazy first act, is it creates a specialness in these slowed down love scenes.
And you mentioned just now dynamics, Michael, and I think that those dynamics are in the performances as well. Alex, you briefly mentioned earlier how huge Nicole Kidman is willing to be and goofy, right? Like, yeah. That is the thing about this, when there's like the slapstick parts of the humor. Ewan McGregor and Nicole Kidman and every other member of the cast is not afraid to look really goofy and funny and weird.
Yeah.
That's part of the other reason I love Spectacular Spectacular.
Yes.
Where everybody is just like,
right,
we are now in vaudeville, right?
And yeah.
Like, I love it, but it also helps the dynamics and the performance really land, where when they are like in love and there's just these quiet moments between the two of them and they're doing, you know, sort of the more, I'm not going to say it's small acting, but it is like more grounded, you know, sort of emotional, serious acting, helps to draw us into those moments even more, because we've seen like the big version of it and then here's the quieter version of it. It's just beautifully performed by them, but I'm sure also just really well directed by Baz Luhrmann in those moments.
Right. Yeah. The Spectacular Spectacular sequence is also one of those ones that's just like not really for me, but it definitely is like just presented as very like you literally have Looney Tunes, you know,
it's Looney Tunes.
sound effects happening and stuff. And the thing that makes me laugh the most is when they're all just bouncing up and down and Nicole Kidman is one of them.
Yes, it's one of my favorite shots ever.
And I think if she weren't in that shot, I'd just be like, I'm over it. But because she is, and she's sort of like, she has easily the most work to do in this movie, because
oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Even the biggest of characters. I mean, I freaking love Richard Roxburgh as the Duke, you know, and Jim Broadbent, but they are playing these sort of one note characters. They're doing it beautifully, but Nicole Kidman has to sort of be very serious and dramatic and very romantic and very in love and very insane and over the top. And she does.
She has to faint all the time.
So much coughing and fainting and gasping.
Yeah.
Falls down almost as much as Frodo. Yeah.
A perfect example of the transitions she has to make is the beginning of Your Song, where she's literally rolling on the ground, wrapped in a blanket, like doing a fake orgasm to his poetry. And then, like, seconds later is this beautiful shot of her where she's being taken in by his song and just completely changed, and the kind of blanket is coming down. And it's always one of my favorite shots.
That shot is so gorgeous.
I think part of why it lands so hard is because you've been whipped around by this like farcical misunderstanding scene, and then the song hits and the music swells and their performances are just so earnest. And so when they make those transitions into serious drama, into the serious love scenes, they don't bring any of the farce with them. They're just 100% there in this new state, and it just lands.
Right. I think you get that same dynamic shift in the Sound of Music scene. It goes back into cartoon world, but for the moment where Ewan McGregor sings that one line, the movie is doing that sort of thing where it's like, you can stop being stressed out for a second and start like just like hugging this like lovely romantic big moment, you know? And I think that like, it's that same shift that it does when it goes into Your Song. And even if I don't love those sequences, like when it does do that shift, I'm like, maybe like you're saying, all the more excited to go into that new part because now it's giving me what I want.
It's extra satisfying when suddenly Ewan McGregor starts singing and the orchestra comes up. It's always the best.
And also just because Nicole Kidman, as if she didn't have enough work to do, she also had a stress fracture to her rib that happened in rehearsal, and then also like broke her leg or something happened where she shot several scenes in a wheelchair.
Oh my God.
Insane.
Yeah, I think I was reading she like cracked or broke several ribs, or like multiple ribs during the production. Once from a corset, once from like a dance accident. Yeah, so her body went through a lot in this movie.
And there was also like a lot of kind of doomed like production-y things. Like on the very first day of set, they were all set to roll. It was fine. And like, we're going to make this movie. And then Baz Luhrmann found out that his father died that day. So they had to shut down on the first day of shooting.
Well, and it's dedicated to his father, this movie.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I always liked that, the way that end card looks and just the way it's like animated and lit. I don't know. There's just something very special about that. But then they were also like racing against time and had a hard out because Ewan McGregor's other great 2000 performance as Obi-Wan, Attack of the Clones, was getting ready to shoot in the very same studio. And so they like barely made it and they had to like destroy all the sets because they didn't have time to save them. And so like the elephant and all that stuff, like Attack of the Clones was just like, no, you gotta get out of here. And so they had to just like destroy everything.
My God.
So just, there was a lot of pressure on the production, as if making movies isn't hard enough normally.
As if making this movie isn't hard enough.
Right.
Right. Right.
Yes.
Another thing I always think about, kind of going back to Baz Luhrmann's, you know, the Romeo and Juliet thing, that this this film feels very similar and kind of borrowing a lot of the Shakespearean, I guess, you know, that melodrama thing. It starts with, you know, the idea of doomed lovers, right? You know, like from the beginning,
right,
Satine is going to die. It's that tragic ending kind of thing. It is more powerful to me in this movie for some reason than in Romeo and Juliet. Not to like, I'm realizing I'm opening a whole door into Shakespeare that we don't need to go through right now. But I feel like that's one of the things that he brought from that movie that fits really well in this film, that allows it to have fun party scenes and like pure love, but also can go to these like dark, heavy places like the tango sequence, which is maybe the best thing ever put up. I don't know, like, that's, you know, you can argue about that. This really just, I just want to talk about the tango, so I'm just trying to get us to the tango so we can talk about the tango.
Well, I have one thought about that, and then I promise we'll get to the tango because I want to talk about it too. But thinking about the script, the frame story with Christian sitting typing at his typewriter is kind of what makes this script hold together.
Yeah,
because otherwise it really would not. It would be a complete disaster, because so many of the beats, especially in the second act, but even going into the third act, are really the same beats, where it's like, someone noticed that they were together. That person might tell the Duke. The Duke is going to insist that he sleeps with Satine. She's going to get out of it. And that happens like four times. Like, that's just kind of what the second act of this movie is. They attempt to raise the stakes on each one, where it's like, no, she really is going to have to do it this time. She really can't get away with it. If you didn't have this build toward what we know is ultimately an actual tragic ending.
Right.
And I think the movie does a good job of making us wonder. We know she's sick, but we don't actually for sure know that that's how she's going to die. We know that she's going to die. The movie does a good job of kind of making that a sort of mystery, a little bit of a mystery box, where it's like, she is going to die. She is sick. But there are other forces at work here as well. So if we weren't pointing towards that actual tragic ending, none of the middle act of this would like feel eventful or like feel like there were real stakes at all. Once we get through like, okay, you're going to have to go sleep with the Duke. But like, she's confessing. And there are just so many. And then you have like a virgin, which is, you know, a great little delay in the whole thing.
So great.
Those beats wouldn't have any. They wouldn't be meaningful at all if you didn't have that frame story. And so I do think it's really smart. And I think it's also a tribute to Ewan McGregor's performance throughout, which, you know, we talked a lot about just now about Nicole Kidman. Ewan McGregor is great in this. He's really adorable and really
so earnest.
He's kind of just really perfect for it, though, because he has.
Well, his smile is so sweet. He has like a twinkle in his eye. It's not something you can like easily replicate.
But his jealousy is also dark.
Right.
Which maybe this is how we get to Roxanne. But
we're getting to it, Michael. We promise.
Right. Baby steps.
Yeah, I think for me, I was thinking like, how would I feel if I just watched this movie right now out of nowhere, you know, and let's take Ewan McGregor out of the equation, because you tell me Ewan McGregor is going to like sing and be in love for 2 hours, I'm going to watch that movie. But like if it was just like some unknown, you know, actors or whatever. And I think that even if something like Sound of Music scene would take me out of it, it does have that very strong, emotional, romantic kind of dark opening, like you're saying, Trisha, where it's just sort of the woman I love is dead and, you know, all this stuff. He's sitting at his typewriter brooding and everything. And I think that at least is a glimpse that the movie is like, look, we are going to go here. We are going to go to these places. We're going to narcoleptic Argentinian first, but like we're going to go like to all these crazy places. But like this movie is also this thing, you know, and I think that is sort of that dynamic shift that we've been talking about.
Amongst the many other things it's doing while doing all that editing, it is constantly foreshadowing things and reminding you, you know, the first time you see Satine, there's a brief like fade in, fade out of her dying. Like they're taking shots from the end and like sprinkling that throughout. So it is kind of constantly reminding you that, yeah, there's this dark place. And I feel like the tango is like the payoff of that, like the foreshadowing of like the dark, like this is how like serious we're going to go. And I just like everything about it is amazing. And I just want to it's just so good. Like the blend of like cinematography and editing and choreography, where it's all telling the story, like all the pieces are telling the story. And then it's kind of it's a metaphor story happening for what's going on. Like there's just all these levels that are happening in this perfect synchronicity. And it's just like, it's pure happiness when I watch it.
Yeah, I think it's a great blend of the two dynamics sort of coming together. Because when you are in spectacular world or like a virgin world, the movie is very clearly going, look, we're just going to have some fun for a few minutes. And, you know, there's still like the characters have an objective and you understand what they're trying to do. But the movie is very clearly tonally going, we're just going to have some fun. And Roxanne, at first, you're like, oh, it's another kind of fun thing. Like they're covering Roxanne, which is already like kind of a silly thing. And like, you know, the Argentinian is kind of like a little bit of a cartoony character is the one sort of driving it all. And they're making a tango out of it, which is funny, but it doesn't get too cartoony. It's sort of like in this larger than life musical world, but it's not spectacular, obviously. But then you shift into Ewan McGregor saying, you know, his hand upon your hand, his touch, whatever, you know, those lines are. And you're like, oh, okay, this is, now we're getting dark, we're getting jealousy, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then you crescendo with him, you know, actually when Ewan McGregor starts like actually singing and he's just so broody with his collar turned up and everything while the rest of the song is also coming to its crescendo. So it's like one of those moments where the two sort of extremes of this movie come together in like kind of a perfect way.
Roxanne makes me think about the phrase, the promise of the premise. Mm. Because it is taking a song that you will for sure recognize from pop culture. Most people, maybe not youngsters, from pop culture will recognize, transforming it into this operatic, very dramatic, brilliantly choreographed dance and song number, interwoven with original like music and musical sort of cues that are being sung by the characters, married into the plot of the movie, and then incredibly beautifully filmed and cut together. You're dying for it to do this the entire time, and it gives it to you in Roxanne. There's an audible gasp, or there was an audible gasp among the teens that I showed this to when we got to the Roxanne scene, because it doesn't immediately resolve into the melody, right? It starts off with this just like cool violin note, and they're going to talk about, we're going to do a tango now, which already a tango itself is a powerhouse of a song and dance. And so it's like, we're going to do a tango, which is this really intense, you know, almost like fight of a dance number. And it starts with that violin melody. And you have the Argentinian talking, starting to tell this story. And then when it resolves into the melody of Roxanne, every teen in the room went, like that, where they were just like, oh my God, because they probably, you know, they don't know where they know Roxanne from. It's like their parents are listening to it on the radio, maybe while they're in the car, you know, or whatever. But it is, it's drawing on something deep, like a deep, like melodic thing from pop culture that we're familiar with while doing all of the story and emotional things at the same time. Ah, it's so good.
The other great thing about the sequence is it's a cross-cut sequence with Nicole Kidman's character, you know, basically being like assaulted by the Duke in the climax, and the way everything is cut together. You know, we talked about the Christopher Nolan cross-cut. I mean, this is a cross-cut. Like, it is cross-cutting in this, once again, in that almost non-linear, non-logical, you're just on this wave of emotion and build. That's why the editing is so astounding, because I don't know how you could like think this through. Like you'd have to just feel it in the edit. And yeah, she felt it.
Yeah, I think this is the sequence that made me be like, oh my God, editing. Like that's like a thing that can happen. Editing.
Yep.
And yeah, like if you like truly like take the scene and like watch it frame by frame, like watch every shot, because it the same way you're saying, Trisha, of like how it's the promise of the premise and all these other ways, it's doing all the editing language that has been established within this world here in full effect. It starts mostly conventional, like you can understand space and time and things are kind of playing out naturally, but as the song builds, as it's doing more of this cross-cutting, you know, to Nicole Kidman's story, you know, you see a flash of, you know, the Duke opening the box with the necklace in it, and like you see her reaction for like three frames, like just a little like taste, and it starts like it's having so much fun, but it's so with the music and with the story in these little like tiny imperceptible ways, like you said, Alex, like you can only, like it's the kind of editing you can only do when you like really feel it and when you're completely in sync with what the movie is trying to be.
It's so well married to the music, and that's why you can get away with three frames on her face, is because there might be a quivering of the violin at that and during those exact three frames, and that synchronicity just creates a flow in your brain as you're taking in the scene.
And the narrative element that they overlay onto the song, like the, Roxanne is a song that has kind of a narrative element to the lyrics anyway, but then he's like, this is a song from Buenos Aires, and like this is, you know, the story of that we're telling, and the choreography is also telling a narrative, which is very, you know, is a meta narrative or like a reflection of the what's happening with Satine's storyline and Christian's storyline anyway, about jealousy and this like feeling of betrayal and all this stuff. There's a complete narrative arc to the sequence and to the song that is built into the music, into the edit, into every performance. Caroline O'Connor as Nini, you know, who's the central dancer in this, is unreal. Her performance at the end, I just think of that, the glimpses we get of her spinning, like that beautiful like pirouette, is just it is creating that entire journey that the song takes you on, of like, here's the opening, you know, here's the exposition of this little mini story, this little mini arc we're going to give you, take it all the way to this climax and leave you with this like tragic ending. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, and it's definitely, it's doing what jukebox musicals should do, which is we are using an existing song to do something narratively. You know, I think as a huge Nirvana fan, like when It Smells Like Teen Spirit starts, I'm just like, why? What is this? I don't, you know, like, what are you doing here, song?
It is really interesting how, like, Nirvana fans seem to be, like, pretty upset about that.
Yeah.
Like, there's, like, a subset of people that are, like, really offended by that song. Which I
feel like Queen fans would be more into The Show Must Go On and the way that it's used in this. Mm. But, yeah.
I'm not offended by it. It just, like, I didn't care. I wasn't like, oh, my gosh, the song, you know, I grew up with is in this movie.
Right.
As opposed to the Elephant Love Medley and Roxanne, and a lot of times where it's like, oh, we are actually taking lines from the song or segments from the song and using them for a narrative purpose in a way that feels like it blends together and that kind of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like The Show Must Go On is kind of like low-key my favorite. Like, I love the tango, I love the Elephant Love Medley, but The Show Must Go On, that sequence, there's just so much emotional baggage, and the performance, like Jim Broadbent, is just like so great.
I love him in this movie so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just, you know, I do feel like some of the maybe weakness of the story is, and maybe this is part of the melodrama, is like sometimes the motivations you don't super feel or you're not completely on board with, of like, you know, Satine's gonna leave and go be happily ever after, but now after 30 seconds she's decided she can't and she's gonna lie to Christian. Like, it just happens very quickly, and I feel like the movie is less concerned about like getting you to buy in with the mechanics and logic of it as much as just the emotion of it, right? Obviously
it's opera logic is the thing,
right? Mm-hmm.
We go see operas that are in different languages, and we just kind of are like, all right, that guy is going to fight that guy now. And you're just kind of there. You don't really need to understand why.
Right.
Right. Because you're just there to be entertained by the opera of it. So I feel like there's definitely some opera logic that's happening here that the film is not too worried about. Just you roll with it.
Two things I'll say about that scene that I think you're talking about, Michael, where Satine is really telling Harold, like, I'm leaving. He loves me. I don't need you. I don't need the Moulin Rouge anymore. And then he stops her in her tracks with, you know, you're dying. I love that scene from a writing perspective, actually, because it's very on the surface, the tactics that are being used. Like, Harold like uses various like reasons why she should stay until it's clear she's going to walk out the door, and then he drops the "you're dying." So I think it's just a nice thing to point to of like, here is a character trying to get something out of another character, trying different tactics, and then they bring out their like nuclear option. And I also think that the operatic thing Trisha's pointing to that this movie does both here, and then I want to talk about the ending, how the ending plays out. There's a shortcut you have with music where you can have Satine go through a kind of an entire process of accepting reality and grieving it all in a few moments when she sings this like reprise from "One Day I'll Fly Away," where she changes the words to say, "Today is the day when dreaming ends." That is all you need. Like you just need her to sing that line with her looking at the birdcage, and that's all you need to know.
14-year-old Michael was like, wait a minute, this is symbolism. Yeah. I think I figured it out. This shot is symbolism.
They did a thing.
And it goes straight from there into "The Show Must Go On," which, as you're pointing out, Michael does a lot of narrative work where there's a really hard switch. And "The Show Must Go On" is a short sequence by comparison to a lot of the other ones in this movie. But it is doing plenty of narrative work. And it finally gives us Jim Broadbent, which we've been like missing this whole time since the Can-Can, basically. It highlights that critical switch that leads to the crisis for the characters, and Nicole Kidman plays it so beautifully.
And she looks so cool as she's walking out of the theater with the beautiful cinematography and the lighting. It's just so good.
I remember them talking about in the commentary, like, it was all shot on stages. There was no exterior shots. And for that sequence, they basically got every light that they had to try to create the look of sunlight and, like, almost burned everything down.
Love it.
But it's so worth it.
Absolutely worth it.
Right. And it's doing that thing that you're talking about, Brian, where it's like, it's using that jukebox musical thing. It's using the song and the power of the song to put you, like, right in the headspace with all the characters, and you get it. And yeah, just the buildup, again, to the crisis, like you're saying. And then I feel like this movie has just the best, like, break in, like, the buildup to act three is just so intense, where it's like Christian's sad, but he has this monologue. He's going to sell his typewriter. And it, like, and again, it's this really quick switch where, like, the motivations are sort of like, well, Toulouse came in and, like, told me things, and now I can't get it out of my mind. But then it goes into, like, so I had to go back to the Moulin Rouge one last time. And then, like, the sped up, like, hands, it runs into the carriage for some reason. Then it goes in, and then bam, you're in act three.
And then we're into the crazy, like, their actual musical, which begins with an actual Bollywood, insane right. song.
Right.
Insanity. Yeah.
Going into act three, which I think is my favorite sequence of the film, which maybe is obvious for me because I tend to just be obsessed with endings that stick the landing, Return of the King or anything that sticks the landing and gives me that emotional payoff. I'm just always so, I just have gratitude for the film for completing the experience, giving me more than I even expected, and just leaving me feeling like, you did it, director. And the finale does that for me because it uses the musical format to essentially solve a relationship with a single song. Like, their relationship is brought to the lowest low. I mean, Christian literally, like, insults her on stage in front of everybody, says, "You're nothing to me," walks away. And then somehow with a single song and finale, you completely buy that everything is healed between them and all is right in the world before then she has her tragic ending. I think that's magical. Like, I can't believe that this form, the musical and those performances in a song, can actually believably take these two characters from their lowest low to their highest high in like 3 minutes. And there's something magic about that I think can only happen in a musical. Which is why I love it so much, because I think it's the ultimate usefulness of this format to tell a story. Because I don't think you can make those kinds of emotional transitions without the power of music. It's the only way you can, like, believe it in your heart when you're watching it.
Well, the gauntlet is really thrown down when you do a musical, because even a jukebox musical, you basically still have to write an original song. Like, you kind of can't pick any song from pop culture to be your, like, big song. So you still have to write an original song. And "Come What May" is a really, really good one. And so And the fact that it's a reprise, there's a reason why musicals do reprises. It's because they lay groundwork, emotional groundwork, and then they drill back into it to get your emotions back at the end. It is really clever. I mean, this is a very, very old trick in the book. I say trick. It's a tool.
Yeah.
It's not a trick in the sense that, like, it's not cheap. It's hard to do well. They set up this beautiful thing and they give you a meaning for it. It's the same thing when you use any sort of symbol. A melody is also doing a symbolic psychological thing to you.
Yeah, right? Motif. Yeah.
Where when you recall it and bring it back. Yes, a motif. Exactly. A leitmotif, as it's called in music, right? When you bring it back, it brings back those emotions for you. And I think this is the melody and the execution of Come What May at both times, but especially during the finale, is just, this is what musicals do at their best. And here it is for you.
Well, and it's that power of the editing too, where there is a lot of chaos up to that pivotal moment. There's the Duke's bodyguard is trying to kill Christian and they're fighting, and Toulouse is up in the rafters trying to shout down at them, and it's complete chaos. And then everything slows all the way down for this moment. It's completely silent as Satine turns around and begins to sing. And the beginning of the song is very stripped down. Like, there's almost no music at the beginning, and it doesn't really swell until Christian, you know, responds and walks back towards the stage. So yeah, it's just all the tools that we've been talking about that this movie has used to make things land,
right?
Like that, to me, is the ultimate moment of things landing. And that's what you want from a finale. You want time to slow down, and you want it to have slowed down. Like, you want to sit in this climax moment with like time standing still, and the movie does it 100%.
Yeah,
very much.
I think that's a great way to lead into what are some lessons that we're going to take away from Moulin Rouge. Tricia, you want to start us off?
I have a relatively quick lesson, but watching this again, especially when I was watching it with the young people that I showed it to, they really found the Duke to be a very, very upsetting villain. And I think he is. And it's, you know, Richard Roxburgh is great in this. But the design of the Duke on the surface doesn't necessarily seem like it has the ingredients for a really menacing villain. I think it was in the Devil Wears Prada video, we were talking about establishing the power of the antagonist. And the Duke doesn't immediately come across as being particularly powerful. And for most of the movie, he's being an idiot, right? Where it's like everyone in the entire Moulin Rouge knows that she's in love with Christian. And he's the only person who's so deluded and so stupid that he can't see that. There's a lot about him that, like, on paper, isn't that scary or formidable as a villain. But one thing the movie does really well is tap into how dangerous his insecurities are.
Yes.
And I just think there's a really well-observed realism to it that really imbues him with a lot of menace, actually. I don't know if you guys have ever heard, this is like in the conversation around like sexual assault, you know, sort of Me Too kind of things. The reminder is that men are afraid women will reject them, and women are afraid men will kill them. And that piece of wisdom is really embodied in this dynamic between Satine and the Duke. And it's a real dynamic that gets women killed every day because men can't deal with rejection. Again, he's kind of a one-note villain, and that's kind of his only note, but it's a strong enough, well-observed enough note that it does make him effectively scary within the world of the Moulin Rouge, where her entire job is to fool him. And if she can't do it, then he will kill her, essentially, or kill the person she loves. It creates a kind of baseline set of stakes for everything that unfolds after that. It's smart character design. And it's, again, like I said, brilliantly played by the actor here. So,
yeah, definitely. I think it is sort of, there's an unraveling of his character too, that sort of
very much
fits tonally with the movie. Because at first he is the bumbling idiot, and then he's the guy who will take the money away if you don't do what he says. And then he's the guy who will literally kill someone, you know? And it's like, that's the arc of the movie. And it's also the arc of the sort of the development of his character.
You mentioned earlier that the movie doesn't tell you how Satine dies at the beginning. And it's very smart. And when he's walking towards the stage with the gun at the end, you very well might think he's going to shoot Satine. That's how she's going to die. And the movie really plays with that expectation that he might be the one who kills her. Mm-hmm.
And it does hint at it at the very beginning, where when he insists on the contract, that like he's like, I will have this contract that binds Satine exclusively to me. And then he has that moment where he totally devolves and he's like, I don't like other people touching my things. Mm-hmm. He's scary. And so from that moment on, we know the dark place that his insecurity leads to, and it's really violent. And so I think that's another part of the big reason that he's able to be a true villain for most of this movie.
Yeah. Like, we know so little about him and really all the characters, but like, I feel like in this case, it, like, knowing so little about his backstory does kind of just let him be this pure emotion, pure menace thing that you're kind of talking about, where it's like, it's all you need to know is how you feel about him. Like, that is what this character is. And it's very clearly communicated and utilized.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Brian, what's your lesson?
So I've never seen Joel Schumacher's Phantom of the Opera movie. But my lesson
That's
comes from it.
Okay.
But how do you know that you have a crush on Emmy Rossum? Okay, go
ahead. A friend of mine saw the movie, and right after she saw it, she said, the stage show is so big and impressive for its medium. Like, as a piece of theater, it's so big and impressive as a piece of theater. And she said the movie was bigger than the stage show, but it wasn't big and impressive for a movie. Instead, it just felt like a movie. So it wasn't sort of within the medium. It wasn't using everything, you know, all the tools that are there, is everything we've been talking about. And then I remembered that when I saw the opening shot of Les Miserables, the movie, the recent one, which is like coming out of the water and going over the ship and then zooming into Hugh Jackman. And it's like, whether you like it or not, that is using the medium to do something that you cannot do on stage, obviously. And I think Moulin Rouge is an example of a movie musical that uses its medium to the fullest.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's not just production value. It's also everything we've been talking about: editing, effects, voiceover, nonlinear storytelling, all these things you either can't do at all in a stage show, like editing, obviously, or you just can't do them to the same effect that you can do on film. That's sort of the culmination of everything we've been talking about, is Moulin Rouge uses its medium to the fullest. And I think that lesson doesn't just apply to musicals. Any movie can benefit from utilizing all the cinematic techniques at their fingertips. They don't have to use all of them like Moulin Rouge does, every single cinematic thing at once. But, you know, every movie should at least be considering the opportunities that film allows for.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Alex, what's your lesson?
Mine is just that earnestness stands the test of time. You could have done like a postmodern take on the movie musical, a jukebox musical that is the entire time kind of tongue-in-cheek or wink-winky, or isn't this kind of silly that it's a musical? And I don't think it would age very well, because we'd be looking back on it and be maybe kind of annoyed with it now. But Moulin Rouge, for me, ages wonderfully, because at its core, it's just an earnest, 100% classic love tragedy melodrama, you know, and it just commits to it, and the actors commit to it, the director commits to it, and it's not trying to hedge its bets by being a little bit cool about it or wink-winky about it. It's no, this is a full-fledged melodrama love tragedy, and we're going to do it, and we're not going to pretend like it's something cool or modern in this, you know, 2001 way. And I just really respect the bravery it takes to do that in a modern film. Just, we're gonna make an old-fashioned big love story, and nobody here is gonna be winking about it. We're just gonna do it. So
mm-hmm.
Kudos to Baz Luhrmann and Nicole Kim and Ewan McGregor for just doing it.
Yeah
we're talking a little bit before we started recording off mic, and I was like, this is a movie where my opinion of it hasn't changed in 20 years. The way some movies are like, that was good at the time or when I was this age. I'm like, Moulin Rouge, because it is just being this thing that is in and of itself and is not trying to be 2001. It's not trying to be anything. It's like everything I felt about it then, I feel about it now in exactly the same way. And it's sort of like a time capsule in a way. Other movies, you're like, oh, that movie really hasn't aged well. Movies don't really do this thing anymore. It's like, movies didn't do any of this stuff in 2001 either. Right. So it sort of feels, yeah.
Good point.
It's one of those 20-year-old modern films that does things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's also interesting to note that like this was pre 9/11. Like, I think that also is worth, you know, adding to the context. Again, like you guys are saying, this was also just aberrant even for its time. But I feel like especially after that, the idea of earnest emotion happiness was not a thing that we had in movies a whole lot.
Not for a while.
Yeah, my lesson is kind of off the heels of what you were saying, Brian, of just like, this is a movie that uses every part of the cinematic language. And if you are wanting to learn filmmaking, movies that turn the dial up to 11 are useful, whether they're good or bad, whether you like them or not. It reveals the capabilities of those techniques to you, so it makes them easy to study. And so obviously, editing does so much of the work here. And I think also, you know, we've talked about how the aesthetic choices and just all of the what great editing can do. I think you can also feel that the editing is duct tape on an insane movie. Like, I think a lot of the times it's managing to do emotional work while also just barely keeping this thing together.
Yep.
And I think that's why it's so useful to study and why it was such an influence on me. And I remember making trailers for random just movies that I made up, and I would put the Moulin Rouge music on there, and suddenly I'd feel this freedom of like, I'm just gonna cut to a shot of like a cat or like an explosion. It doesn't really make sense, but I'm just gonna experiment and have fun. And I think a lot of editing is doing that. It's like, you're trying to do something, you can get stuck in the way you imagined it happening before. So occasionally just put in a random shot of something else and it'll do something. It'll either make you realize this is definitely not the way to go, or it'll spark some idea. And I feel like Moulin Rouge is like, that's what the entire movie is. It's just so much stuff crammed together. And, you know, you couldn't sit down and like write out on a piece of paper, like, I'm going to cut to this shot for two frames here. And that's like, you have to feel it. And I feel like it's such a great example of that. And it's kind of segues also into my, what are you watching? So Skillshare is the sponsor for this episode. And so since I knew we'd be talking about editing, I was trying to find a lesson, basically a course on video editing. And so there's a class on Skillshare called Video Editing Techniques, a Practical Guide to Creating Visually Appealing Edits. And so it's sort of for people that know a little bit about editing, but want to get a better sense of everything that we're talking about. Like, how do you approach editing? What is the function of editing? And, you know, the teacher does a good job of sort of saying, like, before you dive in, think about the story that you're trying to tell. What's the emotional effect you want the audience to have, and have that in your brain while you're playing around with things. And he also points out, you know, using music and music videos is a great way to learn editing, because there's a freedom that comes with that medium. And so it encourages experimentation and for you to kind of get the feel of how editing works in a way that then is, you know, can transfer to any kind of editing style. So it's a cool class. I recommend you check it out. If you don't know what Skillshare is, I'm going to tell you very quickly. Skillshare offers thousands of inspiring classes for creative and curious people on thousands of topics: illustration, design, photography, video, freelancing. I've used them to learn about JavaScript and coding so that I can make templates for After Effects. There's lots of things on there. So if you want to learn more about pretty much anything, you can head to skillshare.com/beyondthescreenplay. And when you use our offer code, you get a free trial of premium membership. Most classes are under an hour, so it's like a quick hit of knowledge, which is also pretty useful. So anyway, skillshare.com/beyondthescreenplay to learn more about lots of things, including editing, which will help you make Moulin Rouge if you decide to make Moulin Rouge one day. Alex, what have you been watching recently?
So on the topic of tragic love stories, I recently watched Supernova, which is a drama starring Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth, who play a gay couple dealing with...
Cute!
Well, it's adorable. Yeah, they are adorable.
Isn't it really tragic, though?
It's super tragic. But like, they play the characters so beautifully. Like, they really do feel like a real lived-in couple. And they're so, it's just sweet.
I love them.
It's like a sweet, tender story between these two men. But Stanley Tucci's character is dealing with the reality of being diagnosed with early onset dementia. And so it's basically this like farewell tour, kind of like they're going to see all their friends and family. It's really sad. It's a very simple, small movie, but their performances are really what it's all about. I mean, it's the movie kind of ends and you're like, oh, it's over now. That was very simple and very small, but that's not really what it's about. It's not a big story. It's just about these two performances and these two men. And damn, are they good. Yeah. they're just really wonderful. So nice. If you want to have a sad, tragic night with Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth, I recommend Supernova.
Wow. I can barely handle just your description of it.
I know. I was like getting choked up like as I was describing it.
Yeah, they're so great. Yeah. Okay, cool. Brian, what have you been watching? Cheer me up.
Maybe not.
I've been patiently waiting for Nomadland to come out and become viewable to regular people who are at home. And it finally is out now. And it's written and directed by Chloe Zhao, based on a book by Jessica Bruder, and stars Frances McDormand. It's about older people who lost their homes during the 2008-2009 recession and decided to start kind of a nomadic community where they would travel around the country and live out of their vehicle and just sort of find peace and happiness in that lifestyle. And Frances McDormand, as you'd expect, is insanely amazing. It also stars David Strathairn, who is gracefully turning from a handsome middle-aged man to a handsome older man. He's doing a great job of that.
I was going to say, it's a specialty of his.
Right.
Yes.
The most impressive thing, actually, is the rest of the cast, or most of the rest of the cast, where I'm watching this movie going, did this director just find the best unheard-of actors in the world who can give the most naturalistic performances? Or did she find real people who can just be themselves amazingly on camera? It turns out it's the latter. They're actually the real people that Jessica Bruder wrote about in her book.
Whoa.
She found them and just hung out with them. I need to watch like some sort of behind the scenes on this to see how these scenes were actually filmed, because they clearly are just telling their own stories, but they're also clearly acting, like they are communicating with Frances McDormand. It's not just a camera's on them and they're talking like a documentary, but it's sort of blurring the line between documentary and movie because these characters are just talking about their own lives. And so it's beautiful to like get their stories, their very real stories, and have them say that. It's also doing movie things. And by the second half, it's like now it's more of a movie, but still in a way that it all blends together really well, partially because Frances McDormand is so good at being naturalistic that you're not going, oh, now I'm watching this actor. When I was watching these real people, it all worked. Like the real people are good actors and the actors are good at being real. So it all works together really well. And it's a beautiful film. It's on Hulu now, Nomadland.
Great. And Trisha, what have you been watching?
I decided to do a double feature of kind of like sexy heist movies that I somehow hadn't seen, basically. Sexy heist movies are like my favorite thing in the whole world anyway. So I watched the original Thomas Crown Affair.
Okay, cool.
Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway, and they're incredible. It's really, really good. Really interestingly directed and put together. If you have not seen it, it is truly, as far as I can tell, truly nothing like the 90s version, which is one that I had already seen. No offense to Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo, who are also wonderful in that version of the Thomas Crown Affair. But so I watched that, and then I watched Out of Sight, which is Steven Soderbergh. And I don't know how I had missed it. I'm like embarrassed actually to admit that I had missed it up until this point in my life. So that's George Clooney and J-Lo. And if you haven't seen that, stop what you're doing immediately.
So good.
And go watch Out of Sight. But it's also, it's in the same vein. It's like so similar in so many ways of like the woman is trying to catch this bad man who's like a criminal, but they're just so attracted to them that there's nothing they can do. It's just so much chemistry and crime and sex and crime. If you're into both of those things, which who is not, check out both of these films. It's Soderbergh. It's honestly Soderbergh. Like it's Ocean's 11, just right before Ocean's 11,
right,
in like all the best possible ways. Yeah. It's really great.
It's the director and star of Ocean's 11. And it's based on an Elmore Leonard novel.
Yeah, also.
Like, Trisha, how have you not seen that?
I'm actually embarrassed. So I'm going to find all of these. There's got to be more sexy crime movies that I'm missing. And I'm going to catch them all at this point. But these were two glaring omissions. And I have rectified that situation. These movies are awesome. So go watch them.
Is it bad that the first thing that came to mind when you said sexy heist movie was Entrapment with Sean Connery and Catherine Zeta-Jones?
No, I think that's the same genre.
Yeah, same genre.
Ocean's 12 star Catherine Zeta-Jones. Come on.
Right.
Trademark beyond the screenplay for a film called Sexy Heist. that we are all now going to write together.
As soon as you said that, I was like, why aren't all movies sexy heist movies? That's kind of all I want.
Seriously.
Yeah. Amazing. Great. Okay, well, this has been our conversation about Moulin Rouge. We want to say a big thank you, as always, to the patrons that make this show possible. I want to say thank you as well to our producer, Vince Major, and our editor, Eric Schneider. I'm Michael Tucker. I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Callaros. As always, our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Send us a tweet and say hi. If you enjoy the podcast, tell a friend about it, and we will see you in the next episode.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.